Charters, agreements, and handshakes. So one of the things that we've discussed this week is sort of each of the elements of your project obviously happens in relationship to other elements of it, and it relies on other people. So we wanted to give you some strategies and talk to you about some mechanisms that you can use in your project to ensure that people are clear about their expectations, that you operate on a basis that's sort of fair and equitable. And to be frank, sort of that when things start to go wrong, you have mechanisms in place to address the things that are wrong. And I like to call this the Lord save me from my partners, colleagues, and boss. Otherwise known as when you hate the people you work with, even though they're super nice. So there's actually a dimmer switch on that light. So if you want to turn it back on, and then along the side, there's a dimmer. There you go. And you can just pull it down a little. There you go. So we're going to start actually with about how you put things in writing. The more partners in a project, the more you need to memorialize any agreements. It isn't that people are mean or malicious. It's just that we're all busy academics and scholars. Often we forget about the agreements and conversations that we have had, particularly when your project lasts 3, 6, 9 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And thus you end up not delivering on them. And by that, what I mean is, say you're in a conversation with your partner who's providing you with sets of images from a library, but they also in the meeting say something like, we'll also give you, 15 hours of metadata work, and you don't write that down. And then 9 months later, you go back to the partner and you say, we're interested in cleaning up the metadata, we're ready for your person to give us 15 hours. And they say, what are you talking about? That's not in writing. We didn't agree to that. So writing things down, particularly amending them when there's agreements that happen in a meeting on the fly, is a really good idea for a project. In part because if you put it in writing, you can't ignore it. There's a track record of what somebody agreed to. If it's in writing, you also can't avoid it. This is particularly important when you have staff members at your partner institutions who change in and out. So one programmer leaves, another one programmer comes in and isn't interested in doing what you guys agreed to. You've got it in writing. This is also important, by the way, when you are working with teams of faculty who may go on sabbatical or on research leave. If it's in writing that they say they're going to be doing that in fall of 2013 and they have a sabbatical, they still have to do that in fall of 2013 because that's what they agreed to, even with their sabbatical going on, okay? The other thing I want to say is that if it's in writing, hypothetically, there is an even playing field for everyone. And by that I mean, oftentimes your project is going to have different types of staff on it. Undergraduate students, graduate students, full-time staff, part-time staff, tenured faculty, non-tenured faculty, professional staff like librarians and museum professionals. If you start by putting things in writing with your project partners and with the people on your team, you're going to come across and begin to agree on things that you wouldn't have found out otherwise. So for example, do your undergraduates get credit on the project even after the project is over and they're no longer on it? Or if you're a graduate student and you contribute to 1/10 of the work, do you get 100% of the credit just like the graduate student who was on your project for 100% of the time and did 100% of the work? Okay? So these are the types of things that can go into a charter. A charter basically is a formal agreement. We've included examples of a charter in your resources section and in your, I think there's one in your example grants as well. A charter basically is a statement of shared values. Basically, this is what we say we're going to do. This is what we believe in. Oftentimes, a charter starts with, this is the abstract of what we're going to do. These are our goals and deliverables. And these are the philosophies we have about achieving them. So I'll talk to you a little bit about sort of what that means very quickly. Things like, we believe in being kind to people and being attentive to email and being, we're going to answer phone calls within 3 days of receiving them. Those sorts of value statements about how you're going to mark and value your labor oftentimes form a large part of a charter. So I've seen charters, there is nuance that says, if you are going to ignore someone's email for more than 24 hours, you're supposed to respond to that email and say, I'm unable to respond to your email in 24 hours. I will get back to you on this date. Okay. It's also a statement of goals. So as a project, what we're working towards are peer-reviewed publications. As a project, we are working towards mentoring our students into jobs and job markets. So the goals are not necessarily always the products of what you're doing for that project. The goals could be about sort of pedagogical aims or methodological aims that you want to achieve. And charters almost always include the types of products you're going to have with your project. So we're going to do articles. Articles are going to be handled this way. We're going to do blog posts. Blogs are going to be handled this way. It's basically just a formal way of writing down all of those things you hopefully are discussing in your first project meetings. So oftentimes it includes sets of rules about behavior, rules about how documentation is going to be handled. When you do documentation, it should have these elements in it, you know, name, title, date, et cetera, et cetera. And there are examples of documentations in your example grants and in the charter resource section that we point you to. One of the key elements in a charter that's a big piece of conversation right now in the digital humanities is about citation and attribution. How do you cite the project in publication in print and digital form? This is particularly important if you have a hybrid project where you are producing digital objects, so like literally individual pieces of data, like a digitization of a page that you have enriched metadata on, but also projects that have things like student projects, or you have a set of labor or a set of projects, products that are only produced by undergraduate students. So they're doing, say, semester-long projects that contribute to your larger project. How do they get citations? You know, do they cite the whole project? Do they cite their little piece in it? Do you have a combined citation where it's treated like a chapter title, which is often what projects in digital humanities do, is they treat embedded projects as sort of like chapters like you would in a book. Fair cite, which we've pointed you to in the Praxis materials, is a conversation that has a lot of documentation about best practices for citing digital projects. Yeah.
I have a question about this.
Yeah.
The writing size tree was quoted in a major, or it was cited in a major journal, but the author only put like our advisor's name.
Yep.
And like, what do you do?
So what you should do is actually write to that author and provide them with the corrected citation. And just say, we noticed that you used an incorrect citation for this project. We ask that when you revise this article, you amend the citation to recognize it. So you don't say, you screwed us over.
Right.
You step in and you say, I noticed you had an error. Let me provide you with the corrected information.
Okay.
So you'll notice, by the way, and I don't know if it's on this deck or the decks at the end, when we get to the last slide in our decks for the whole course, or when I'm giving a lecture, the last slide of my deck is always the citation for that particular lecture or that particular project that I'm presenting on. This way, it's clear, it's out there, it's available. Yes?
So then putting a thing on your about page saying, please cite
yes.
the writing studies tree.
Very much so.
In this way.
Please cite it in this way. The other thing is, if you're going to take digital, if you're going to put out individual pieces of information, when you go to, for example, our GitHub pages thing that Jim was showing you and Travis was showing you, at the one of the sections is, if you're going to cite this data, this is how you cite the data. Okay? Particularly when you get to projects where the data formats may be different than what people are used to, like 3D models, where they potentially are very complex citations that could have the individual objects, the project as a whole, and then the model and the software itself. You want to make sure that those citations are easily cut and pastable to somebody who's writing or citing you. Publishing and credit, I mean, everyone in this room, I'm sure, is aware that there's all kinds of conversation in the academy about publishing and credit and who gets to take credit for whatever. It is important in your project, even if it's just you and one other person, to have a rule about publishing and credit. If you two work on a project together and then you go present this at MLA and decide to write a paper about it, does your co-project director get in on it? And we shared with you the article that Simon and I wrote with a team of people on our Digging Into Data project that specifically addresses this. So this was a project that was about authorship historically in quilts, maps, and paintings, manuscript paintings. the article that's from First Monday specifically addresses that. And we had to talk about the fact that we have 17 people on a project team. We're not going to put out an article most times with 17 authors. You know, chances of all 17 people putting in the same amount of work, slim to none. So I highly recommend that article because it talks about how we came to the final agreement that we did about what constitutes credit for publishing. And the mechanism we decided to use was you must have made a substantial intellectual contribution and be engaged in the revisions of that contribution for credit. So we took basically a 17-member team. I think in that instance, we cut it down to, what, 6 authors, primary authors? And then everybody else became a footnote that we thanked for their original contributions to the project. Anyway, the reason also why I want to highlight this, particularly when you're dealing with computer scientists, is that the order of authorship is important when they go up for tenure and promotion, that you get certain numbers of points for being the first author, certain number of points for being the second author, and on and on. And there's a very formulaic way that in the sciences they decide who gets to be what. And so you want to be attentive to that when you have multidisciplinary teams and ask them how they do their citation and publication credit and then negotiate that as a team. Also about how you're going to communicate. As I mentioned briefly before, you know, what's the rule on email? What's the rule on returning phone calls? Do you have a repository of all the communications you have? Again, our DID ARQ project is a good example of this. We had people in 3 different time zones on a regular basis, oftentimes 4 different time zones. We recorded every meeting we had via a thing called Uvu, which at that point was what was better than Google and Skype. And we posted those recordings to our project repository so that someone who could not attend the meeting virtually could log on at a later date and review the conversation that happened. It also became a way that when we couldn't remember what had been said, something really, really smart because no one took that down in the notes, we could go back and rewatch that segment of the video. Yeah.
Do you need permission from everyone in the team to do that?
Yes. So how we did is at the beginning of every meeting, at the beginning of the project, we negotiated that we would be recording those meetings. Everybody basically signed off on a waiver saying, I understand that during these project meetings, I will be recorded. Every meeting started with us saying, we will now begin recording. You are live. So there were conversations that happened before that recording in the room, but once the actual business of the project happened, that's when we started recording. So when we were gossiping about whatever was going on with the project or the difficulty we were having or something that we felt like wasn't appropriate to be recorded, that all happened before the recording session.
Or after.
And Google Hangout does this really, really easily, and I've made examples. I can show you some, and I can show you how to do it.
Yeah.
One thing about coming here that I know is that my university will want to have pictures of it.
Yep.
And I have my camera with me. I think I actually left in my hotel room. Because I've been concerned about taking pictures without having everybody's approval.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, Denise forwarded me a link of a Flickr photo of us
that I got
online.
From yep. Travis.
From Travis. Yeah, they're from us.
From yeah. Travis. So I was wondering, like, do we all agree to a waiver? And I'm not.
You actually did. There was a checkbox when you registered for this conference about your information and images being published.
Okay.
And you had the option to opt out of the directory. So that's what we call it as a directory. It's basically your photo.
Uh-huh.
So online you could create a profile with your photo and your information.
Uh-huh.
You could opt out of that, and thus you actually don't appear as a registered student to the public.
Okay.
So that we do that actually at the beginning on registration. We don't wait until you get here to ask you these things.
Mm-hmm.
We ask you to do it before you get here. So
okay.
You had the choice to opt out of all of your personal information being collected by anyone other than me.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the option to opt out of any of the photos and things like that that would happen this week. Generally speaking, and this is one of those weird things, it depends on whether or not you are considered being part of the university public events. Your university may have set standards about how it treats public events. So here at Maryland, they will take a photo of you no matter what's going on, but if it's going to be used commercially and they're going to make money off of it, that's then when they want a waiver and an approval from you.
So we don't need waivers generally if it's for educational purposes?
If it's for educational purposes and it's considered something open to the public and a public event, you generally do not.
Okay.
It's the weird manifestation of, like, you know, our fascination with spectacle and publicity is they've sort of negotiated this. Generally speaking, I will tell you this, particularly about photos and project photos. I am very cautious that photos are not taken of people with blatant alcohol use in them or smoking or whatever, choose your substance here. So there were photos taken at the banquet yesterday, but you'll notice almost none of them show, and Travis is very good at this. If there is a beer bottle, it's a beer bottle with a napkin wrapped around the label usually. Just things like that. So that there, it just protects people's perception of what's going on at those events. And this is particularly important when you're receiving like federal funding where you're not allowed to pay for alcohol or state funding where you're not allowed to pay for alcohol. You really don't want your funders pulling up a photo of all of you guys in a drunken bar scene. It's just, it's not good practice. And I tend to be pretty conservative about this. The Europeans, the UK people especially, are less concerned about that. But mine is honestly because I've seen too many instances of people thinking that what they see in a photo is a behavior that continues when somebody's in a professional environment. So I'm a little more careful about it than I would be. I should also mention, by the way, if you have undergraduates on your project teams, when you're negotiating your charter, you should negotiate when undergraduates will be included or discluded from things. So if you're going to a happy hour and you're taking everybody out and your undergraduates are not 21 and the bar is 21, that's going to be a problem. And that's where that roles, responsibilities, and appropriate behaviors comes into play. Negotiating what constitutes appropriate behavior, particularly for people who are like me, where you have a pretty strong personality. You know, are you allowed to yell at a colleague? Are you allowed to make fun of people? Are you allowed to tease people? You know, being aware of those sort of personal sensitivities is a good thing. It's hard to codify that in a charter, but you do want to talk about things like coming in late to meetings. Is it allowed that somebody shows up 15 minutes late to every meeting and leaves 15 minutes early? That happens a lot as academics. You know, we get busy, somebody rolls in late. If the meeting's already started, you all usually have to spend 5 or 10 minutes catching that person up on what happened because they were late. And then the meeting's 25 minutes late instead of 5 minutes late. You know, those sorts of behaviors are things that you would want to think about in your project. And I'm sure Simon and I both agree on this, which is you want to discuss that before the project starts. And you want to also have a causes and consequences statement. If you are late regularly to meetings, what happens? Do we not include you? Do you lose the ability to vote on that project meeting's topic? And this is something he and I have done. If you're not in the room for the meeting, you don't get a vote, regardless of what your role or responsibility is. So if you're a PI on a project and you don't ever show up, you know what? We're going to run your project the way we want to run it, and don't complain to us if what it becomes at the end is not what you thought it was going to be. As long as it complies with the grant, you know, goals and statements and products, that's what it's got to do.
And we have absolutely done that.
Yeah. And this is particularly important, by the way, when you're working with administrators who may be on your project because they are an administrator. So if you're putting in an infrastructure grant or things like that, you know, if your dean is on your grant because they feel like they need to be, what is your expectation of that dean? Do they come to meetings? Do they not come to meetings? How much credit do they get? You have to remember that most administrators used to be faculty, so they should be able to have this conversation politely with you about what constitutes credit or not credit. So other line items that show up in your grant, things like licensing. So if you're doing something that's hugely unique that you think could be picked up for commercial use, so writing software that could be picked up, you know, how do you have licensing? Do you guys charge if you digitize your data? Are you charging to have it redistributed? You know, is it all open access and available? Is it something you want to charge people for? Credits, so that citation, you know, how does somebody cite and give credit to the project, cite and credit to your repository? You also want to, at this stage, list all of the people that are currently partners in your project. And this is the segment that gets amended most frequently in a charter. When you add or drop partners, this is a section you go back to and you update. Issues of preservation, how long are we going to keep the project running, and who's in charge of making sure when the project ends that it actually ends and it goes to its home and final repository for preservation purposes. This is a key element, by the way, for many international projects because there are different rules about preservation internationally. There's also a big issue about access to products. So When we were running our DID grant, there were different rules for different data sets. So the quilt images, some of them could be reproduced, some of them could not. The map images could only be reproduced if the University of Illinois signed off on the publications to those. We had to get all that laid out in this document, in a charter document, so that when I went to go write my article and I included a map snapshot, I knew I had to go back to this librarian at the library to get them to agree to it. Okay? So being explicit about where your data comes from and what the rules are from using it are a big deal. This is particularly important when you're repurposing slide decks. And this is where Simon and I get caught out a lot of times by project partners, is that we will spend hours writing slide decks, and we'll find out 6-8 weeks later that someone took parts of the slide deck we had written and reused them for something else, and never thought to A, tell us, or B, give us credit for the fact that we had spent hours building those visualizations that they see. Okay? So, in these types of agreements, you also list the access to resources. Who gets to tell the OIT people that we need another server or we need more this? Who gets to make the decision about changing the logo? Access to staff is a big one as well. When you're dealing with like an OIT division, a technology division, you know, does somebody get to walk in on your project and find your computer programmer and say, I need you to go do this? Are they allowed to do that? Or do they have to go to you first or the project manager first? I'm very big on this access to staff issue. My staff run a very heavy intellectual agenda of their own, and they are very busy. If you drop in on us and ask us to drop everything to work on something for you, you don't just disrupt that person. You potentially disrupt the 8 or 9 or 10 projects that they're working on. So requests for things to access to our staff, they can go directly to that staff member, but I have to be CC'd on it, and they come to me, and I have to sign off on it before you get time. So you'll notice at some point, oh, I guess he's not in today, he's in Monday. Travis is meeting with one of our project fellows on Monday. They're working on a grant together. That meeting came about because we've negotiated that it's a lot easier for that fellow to go directly to Travis. And when Travis feels like the requests are too much or too little, Travis comes to me and says, I don't know about this, I don't know about that. Can you step in and let him know that I'm too busy to deal with this? In other words, you become a resource for your staff to manage other people's expectations of what they should be doing. While agreements can contain the same information as a charter, an agreement does not necessarily have to be signed by all of the parties within a project. So when it comes to a charter, you want all of your partners to sign as well. You know, all of those people who give you data, all of those people who are signing off, the business manager, the financial person, you name them here on a charter, you want every single person and their mother to sign off. An agreement, on the other hand, can happen just between the core team. So say there are 6 people that are meeting bi-weekly or bi-monthly on this project. They may have their own agreement that follows the spirit of the charter, but is a bit more practical. You know, if you're sitting next to somebody at a desk and they send you an email, you really don't need to send them one back saying, I'm too busy today, I'll get you tomorrow. You're sitting next to each other. You know, those sorts of things. So there are slight modifications you can do in an agreement that are very useful. The most common types of agreements are limited term access to a resource. So another project comes to you and wants to use a piece of your data, or they need access to a member of your staff. We get this a lot with people coming to us to use our graphic designer. I will write an agreement that's an addendum that says you can have Kirsten for 10 hours or 20 hours. So she's actually to be consulting in the next month for the Hornbake Space Library people, because they're going to redesign the lobbies and they're very impressed with the images and the work that's been done here in the Myth Space. A lot of that is Kirsten's aesthetic. So she's going to go talk to them and do some mock-ups for them and help them. That's a side agreement that I've made with the library because they are one of our sponsors. That doesn't get written into our charter that we have with the library. Yes.
So you mentioned that almost everyone here on staff has Fridays off to do their own research.
Yeah.
So how do you determine between when somebody contacts Kristen and that's her own research, she can do whatever she wants on Friday, and something that's not that?
So what it is we have a priority system. So, for example, in this case, the request came to me. I was standing in the nonprint media, and Carlton Jackson sits on the space committee and says, I know when we'd had random conversation when you guys first moved into your space that we were impressed with what was going on, and you had said your graphic designer was the one who'd done some of this work. can we talk real quick? And then Doug, who's on the space committee, walked through non-print media, and he brought Doug over. What happens now is they will send that request to me, and then I will have a conversation with Kirsten about what her workload is at the moment and when she can do it. And I go back to them and I say, Kirsten's available these 3 days. You can have an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever amount of time I judge is useful within the scope of work she has to do and that she has available in her time. And I set the terms for how she engages with them. I act as a buffer. A project manager is a buffer between people who need things and the staff who can do the work. Another type of common agreement is a hidden partnership agreement. This is quite common, particularly in the computer science side of your project. So say you have a group of coders here in your project that are working together, and they realize that they can't do what they need to do, but they know or have a friend who can at another project or another center, and that person agrees to do some free work behind the scenes, under the table, however you want to call it. That's usually a hidden partnership agreement where then I get on the phone with somebody and I say, I know you've got a whole full-time job thing. Listen, you know, you've said you're willing to do this. Let's talk about what we can do to compensate you in non-monetary, non-public ways. So we'll trade things like you need help with graphic design or you need somebody like me to take a look at a grant. And grant writing or things like that is often what we trade in kind in hidden partnerships. I did this for some of you guys this week. You know, you had CVs or letters or project grants that you're working on. You come to me and you say, hey, can you take a look at this? I agree to do that. That's a hidden partnership agreement. That's not something that's actually explicit to what Myth does. We don't provide consulting services of that sort, at least not right now. You know, that's a hidden agreement that we just don't write down, but it's verbal. It exists. Hidden agreements, by the way, often also happen between administrators. So, for example, your provost or your president or your dean may say, I can't explicitly give you this resource, or I can't explicitly give you this staff member, but what I can do is arrange for the two of you to end up in a room together just coincidentally to talk about this issue. This is particularly important when you're in a low resource environment where there may be a lot of scrambling or fighting about having access to certain things. A lot of times hidden partnership or hidden resource agreements can be, we just don't talk about it, but it does happen. Okay? And this is the type of agreement that I'm in most frequently, is project manager to staff member agreement. If you do X, then we'll give you time to do Y. So you heard this from Jim and Travis and Kirsten this week. Jim and Travis both have 20% research release, so one day a week they get to work exclusively on their own work wherever they want in the world. We also, though, have hidden agreements where, like this week, they have done a tremendous amount for me and stepped in. There will be a point at some point this month where I am sure one of the two of them will just be having a bad day or don't feel well, and I will say to them, go home and don't take time off. You know, don't claim that this is vacation time. Don't claim that this is sick time. Go home, work on your couch, go home, lay around, do whatever. Come back to us when you're better. That's actually compliant with the university rules because the university here has telework policies. So I have sent staff home as a reward for doing their job. Don't come in tomorrow, take the day off, and work on your own stuff. As long as they're working on something related to the job that they have, that complies with the university policy. Okay? So the pros or the best parts of doing charters and agreements. They can aid you in getting the entire team on the same page, you know, so you argue about these things before the project starts. They create useful opportunities for dialogue. You know, if you're going to have conflict, likely it'll come out negotiating things like credit and attribution, authorship. It also allows your team to have a clear grievance process. If somebody isn't complying, what's the cause? Who's the person that steps in? 9 times out of 10, it is not your project director who steps in if there is a problem. It's usually somebody who is the machine running the project, okay? So that's your project manager, or it could be your graduate student who's in the day-to-day. Oftentimes, if there is a grievance, it's not the head honcho who's the one doing it initially or figuring it out initially. Usually, it's somebody else or two members of the team getting together and strategizing about how to fix something before it comes to the attention of a project director. This is quite common, by the way, when you're working with large numbers of students, that you want to identify one or two people within that population of workers who could act as the grievance officer to speak on behalf of the group anonymously. So there's somebody on my staff or on my project who is upset, who doesn't want to come directly to tenured faculty member. Creating an intermediary is a good strategy for this. This is also, by the way, very important when you're doing projects with the community, where it may be very daunting for a community member to come to a tenured PhD professor to talk about a problem or an issue they're having. They might be much more willing to come in and talk to, you know, the graduate student who seems very approachable and easy. A lot of times this comes down to personality. You know, I can be very intimidating sometimes, unintentionally or even intentionally. A lot of times we send Trevor in or I send in Travis or Jim to situations to mediate that because they're much more approachable on the face than I am. The important thing about charters and agreements, to be frank, is that it places the onus on the entire team to comply rather than one individual. Everybody agrees, so when something happens, it doesn't mean just one person is the one saying, hey guys, this isn't fair, you're hurting my feelings. They can say, listen, we talked about this and everybody agreed that we were going to do it this way. It takes some of the personal nature out of the process. Okay? What are the cons? Charters and agreements don't address issues of inequality and status directly. You know, it does usually doesn't say in a charter, we recognize that faculty oftentimes can be exploitative of labor practices because we're cheap. It doesn't say things like that. It especially does not address issues of gender and race and sexuality in charter agreements. It doesn't say we recognize that oftentimes women are placed in positions in projects of service and thus we whatever. What it can say, though, is we recognize that every project team member is an equal and responsibility should be borne equally by everyone. So, you know, I'm a labor historian. That's who I was trained by. I tend to pay attention to these things. You know, trying to be attentive to systemic inequalities and how things operate. This is also, by the way, important between tenured and non-tenured faculty that are in the mix. Being clear that just because you have tenure doesn't mean this is a free ride process for you. Or just because you are a non-tenured faculty working on tenure cases that you are not going to be the workhorse for everyone. You know, try not to take advantage of people. The cons of charters and agreements, and this is the thing that I've experienced a lot, is often they get used when the project begins, but what actually works for the team isn't what was agreed to. You know, oftentimes teams can start saying we all agree, and then it becomes a core nucleus of three or four people who really are doing things. Be okay with the fact that people and processes will fall away from the project. Your job as the project director or the project manager is to identify when that has happened, and to have a conversation about at what point it's important to cut ties with a partner or a project or whatever. And we'll talk about those problems in a few minutes. The other cons of charters and agreements, and to be frank, this is why we don't use them on a daily basis here at Myth, beyond sort of the contract stuff we do with grants, is that they always have to be updated. Every time you add somebody new, add a new staff member, you know, a new publication comes out or a new format comes out, it just drives me nuts having to update them all the time. So I generally, if we use a charter agreement, update them on a semester by semester basis. I basically just skim it at the beginning of a semester, note where we need to make changes. We then have a discussion about it in the next team meeting. I give a frequent collaborator discount, as does Simon. Trust is irreplaceable. If this is someone you have worked with before and you trust them, oftentimes, if you ignore me for a while, I'm not going to yell because I know when push comes to shove, you're going to step through and do what you need to do. Trevor will tell you this explicitly, and he, as the Basecamp conversation showed about how things work, I know at the end of the day, if I say to Trevor, it's due on Monday and it's got to leave the door, it will be on my desk and ready to go and polished on Monday. I do not have to harp at him all the time. Frequent collaborator discounts. Also, I want to say to you guys, when you find a successful project team that likes each other and works together, create new projects together. So DID ARQ was born out of a project that we started between two team members that they liked working together, so they brought on a third person. Mike Meredith and Simon are here because that DID ARQ project was hugely rewarding and I learned a lot, and they're very good teachers on the project. That's why they're here. So this is now like the sixth or seventh opportunity we've had to work together. We always opt to work together because we know each other, we trust each other, and frankly, we find each other's personalities pretty funny. Handshake agreements. Oftentimes people want to use handshake agreements, so nothing written down formally. Be wary of untested partners who aren't amenable to formal agreements, even if only an email. And by that I mean somebody new comes into your project who says they're going to give you these really, really great things at a rock-bottom discount, but they won't ever put it in an email or they won't ever write it down. I would ask, why not? Why do you not feel comfortable writing it down? You know, I'd be a little suspicious of those people. Be sure when the project relies on a handshake that if the handshake deal fails, the project can recover. And I will give you an example of this. I was in a situation with a project that I was consulting on externally where there was a handshake deal that started the project, which was, if you do X, we're going to give you a whole bunch of money later on. And that money magically disappeared and the project failed because it didn't have enough resources to finish. Okay, we relied on an administrator who said, if you do this, I'll give you all of these things. But they couldn't give us a handshake, or they couldn't give us a charter, they couldn't give us an email, they couldn't give us a memo. And 8 months later, there was no more money and we had to let staff go. That said, know when a handshake is useful to avoid bureaucracy. Universities are oftentimes, it can take 8, 10, 12 weeks to get something through all the paperwork. If you have a personal relationship with somebody and you can jump all of that legwork, go in, negotiate with them personally, and jump the queue. Jump all that work as much as possible. So all of the computer labs that are being used in McKeldin this week are being serviced and provided for free by the libraries and the IT division there. That was a handshake agreement between myself, Trevor, and the director of ITD in the library. You know, that was, we don't need something written down. You've said you're going to do it. We trust you. We're good. Let's move on. Otherwise, we would have had to put in requests to the campus space people, and then the campus space people would have had to route them to the individual departments to see if they would be willing to give us the labs. And then the labs would have to survey the IT people to see if the software we requested would be useful. It ain't worth all that work. All it took was a phone call and a stop by somebody's office, and we're good to go for DHWI. Yeah?
What's your recommendation to have an administration as part of the project
team? If the administrator is going to actually contribute to the intellectual and developmental work of the project, I'm okay with it. If the administrator can be a public advocate that is informed, and this is the key element, informed about what's going on with the project, then I'm okay with it. What I don't like are administrators who do not know what the project is, but then go out and speak publicly about it as if they do and want to take credit for it or talk sort of expansively about it, and they don't actually know enough to answer questions if there's someone in the audience who asks the question. And that's the dramatic or sort of problematic part of having administrators involved, is that they could be presenting at a conference and mention your project, and somebody in the audience sticks up their hand, and if the administrator doesn't know the answer, and it's an obvious answer, it's going to look a little fishy. You know, so you're looking for administrators who want to actually be engaged and agree on the goals that you're working for and are willing to invest maybe not their time, but the times of their offices and divisions in your project.
So then I have a follow-up question then. Like, administrators are going to talk about what they're going to talk about and can't control that.
Yep.
So do you invite administrators in, like, once a semester, just kind of like, or send them press releases? Or
we invite them in once a semester. So the president of the university is going to be here in 2 weeks. Along with him is coming the vice president for research and the deans of both of the colleges that sponsor us. Mm-hmm. We are giving what we call a show and tell, which is we give them the glossy overview of the three most important things MIT wants to do in the future and specifically say what resources we need to really do those things. The best way to do this is because they usually will not read, you know, copious amounts of material that you produce. They're not going to usually surf your projects or things like that. What we do is we actually give a paragraph cheat sheet with a hyperlink to whoever is that person that's their administrative assistant or person who handles their entire life, every dean and chair and whatever has one. We make sure that that person knows what our project is and that person knows what's going on. Making friends with the people who run behind the scenes is a quick way to make sure your dean or your chair or your administrator knows what's going on with your project. Because oftentimes they walk out of their office to go to a meeting and they say to so-and-so, Sally, or Jim, you know, I'm on my way to go meet with MIT to talk about this Shared Horizons thing. And if that person at the table knows what it is, they can say, yeah, that's that biomedicine data thing. This is who's involved. Here you go. Here's the piece of paper that explains what it is so you can familiarize yourself when you go. The other thing I will say to you is if you are aware that administrators are going to go to conferences or potentially talk about your project, I script remarks, bullet points. So I will be non-diplomatic for a moment, which is that what you heard last night at the reception, although that was definitely Bonnie speaking and that was her voice and her language, we gave her some bullet points, some talking points that she could, you know, think about what she would want to say about what we're doing in humanities and all of that. You know, so don't expect them to create it on the fly. Don't expect them to do this. The other way I should mention this too is letters of support. Almost every grant asks for letters of support. Simon and I both do not actually ask for letters of support without providing a draft to the person we are asking from. That includes the language we think is appropriate or where we think they can fill in language. So we will put things in like abstracts and summaries that they can use in their letter. And then we will put in these six questions we feel like you speak specifically to. I, by the way, for those of you that are graduate students on the job market, do this with my letter writers as well. You as letter writer can speak to my organizational experience. Please answer these questions. Is Jennifer organized? Is she collegial? Is she whatever? And that becomes the core paragraph that they write in their letter. I don't play when it comes to things like this. Everybody's busy. Everybody has time. And to be frank, you can turn around letters and turn around agreements a lot faster if you draft it for people.